When historians ask, "How can anyone deny the Holocaust?" and deniers respond, "We are not denying the Holocaust," it becomes obvious that the two groups are defining the Holocaust in different ways. What deniers are explicitly denying are three points found in most definitions of the Holocaust. 1. There was intentionality of genocide based primarily on race. 2. A highly technical, well-organized extermination program using gas chambers and crematoria was implemented. 3. An estimated 5 to 6 million Jews were killed. Deniers do not deny that anti-Semitism was rampant in Nazi Germany, or that Hitler and many of the Nazi leaders hated Jews. Nor do they deny that Jews were deported, that the property of Jews was confiscated, or that Jews were rounded up and forced into concentration camps where, in general, they were very harshly treated and made the victims of overcrowding, disease, and forced labor. Specifically, here's what the deniers are saying. 1. There was no Nazi policy to exterminate European Jewry. The final solution to the Jewish question was deportation out of the Reich. 2. The main causes of death were disease and starvation, caused primarily by Allied destruction of German supply lines and resources at the end of the war. There were shootings and hangings, and maybe even some experimental gassings, and the Germans did overwork Jews in forced labor for the war effort, but all this accounts for a very small percentage of the dead. Gas chambers were used only for delousing clothing and blankets, and the crematoria were used only to dispose of the bodies of people who had died from disease, starvation, overwork, shooting, or hanging. 3. Between 300,000 and 2 million Jews died or were killed in ghettos and camps, rather than 5 to 6 million. Before I address these claims in detail, let me provide some background on the denier movement and some of the people behind it. After World War II, revisionism began in Germany with opposition to the Nuremberg trials, typically seen as victors' trials that were hardly fair and objective. Revisionism of the Holocaust itself took off in the 1960s and 70s with such books as Austin Apps' The 6 Million Swindle, Paul Rassiner's Debunking the Genocide Myth, and the Bible of the movement, Arthur Butz's The Hoax of the 20th Century. It is in these volumes that the three pillars of Holocaust denial, no intentional genocide by race, gas chambers and crematoria not used for mass murder, many fewer than 6 million Jews killed, were crafted. For the most part, these works have all given way to the Journal of Historical Review, the JHR, the voice of the Institute for Historical Review, the IHR. The Institute was founded in 1978. Its journal, with a circulation of about 5 to 10,000, along with its annual conference, has become the hub of the movement. This movement is populated by a handful of eccentric personalities, including IHR director and JHR editor Mark Weber, author and biographer David Irving, gadfly Robert Farozone, pro-Nazi publisher Ernst Zundel, and video producer David Cole. Running throughout almost all denier literature is fascination with Jews and everything Jewish. No issue of JHR fails to contain something on Jews. The January-February 1994 issue, for example, features a cover story on who killed the Romanovs and drove the Bolsheviks to power. Yes, it was the Jews, the story claims, using a typical denier line of reasoning. Fact: the communists killed the Romanovs and instigated the Bolshevik Revolution. Fact: some of the leading communists were Jewish. Conclusion: the Jews killed the Romanovs and caused the Bolshevik Revolution. By the same logic, fact: Ted Bundy was Catholic. Fact: Ted Bundy was a serial killer. Conclusion: Catholics are serial killers. The Holocaust denial movement has its extremes, and members of its lunatic fringe commonly hold neo-Nazi and white supremacist views. The National Socialist German Workers' Party, foreign organization, hailing from Lincoln, Nebraska, publishes a bi-monthly newsletter, The New Order. Here, one can order swastika pins, flags, armbands, keychains, and medallions, SS songs and speeches, white power T-shirts, and all manner of books and magazines promoting white power, neo-Nazis, Hitler, and anti-Semitism. About Auschwitz, the reader is told, "With systematic German precision, each and every death was recorded and categorized. The small number of deaths over a 3-year period is actually a testament to how humane, clean, and healthy the conditions were at the SS labor camp in Poland," unquote. Mark Weber, David Irving, and company have actively distanced themselves from this side of Holocaust denial. Not all deniers are the same, but the fact remains that in all Holocaust denial, there is a core of racist, paranoid, conspiratorial thinking that is clearly directed at Jews. It ranges from crass anti-Semitism to a more subtle and pervasive form of anti-Semitism that creeps into conversation. For example, "Some of my best friends are Jews, but..." Or, "I'm not anti-Semitic, but..." Followed by a litany of all the things the Jews are doing. This bias is what drives deniers to seek and find what they are looking for, and to confirm what they already believe. Why do they say the Holocaust never happened? Depending on whom you ask, interest in history, money, perversity, notoriety, ideology, politics, fear, paranoia, hate. The word debunking has negative connotations for most people. Yet when you are presenting answers to claims of an extraordinary nature, and Holocaust denial surely qualifies, then debunking serves a useful purpose. There is, after all, a lot of bunk to be debunked. But I am attempting to do far more than this. In the process of debunking the deniers, I demonstrate how we know that the Holocaust happened, and that it happened in a particular way that most historians have agreed upon. Because of the sheer quantity of evidence about the Holocaust, so many years and so much of the world involved, thousands of accounts and documents, millions of bits and pieces, there is enough evidence that some parts can be interpreted as supporting the deniers' views. The way that deniers treat testimony from the post-war Nuremberg trials of Nazis is typical of their handling of evidence. On the one hand, deniers dismiss the Nuremberg confessions as unreliable because the trial was a military tribunal run by the victors. The evidence, Mark Weber claims, consists largely of extorted confessions, spurious testimonies, and fraudulent documents, unquote. Neither Weber nor anyone else has proven that most of the confessions were extorted, spurious, or fraudulent. But even if the deniers were able to prove that some of them were, this does not mean that they all were. On the other hand, deniers cite Nuremberg trial testimony whenever it supports their arguments. For example, although deniers reject the testimony of Nazis who said there was a Holocaust and they participated in it, deniers accept the testimony of Nazis such as Albert Speer, who said they knew nothing about it. But even here, deniers shy away from a deeper analysis. Speer indeed stated at the trials that he did not know about the extermination program, but his Spandau diary speaks volumes. Quote, "December 20th, 1946. Everything comes down to this. Hitler always hated the Jews. He made no secret of that at any time. He was capable of tossing off quite calmly between the soup and the vegetable course, 'I want to annihilate the Jews in Europe. This war is the decisive confrontation between National Socialism and World Jewry. One or the other will bite the dust, and it certainly won't be us.' So what I testified in court is true, that I had no knowledge of the killings of Jews, but it is true only in a superficial way," unquote. In 1977, Speer told a newspaper reporter, "I still see my guilt as residing chiefly in the approval of the persecution of the Jews and the murder of millions of them," unquote. Deniers cite Speer's Nuremberg testimony and ignore all of Speer's elaborations about that testimony. No matter what we wish to argue, we must bring to bear additional evidence from other sources that corroborates our conclusions. Historians know that the Holocaust happened by the same general method that scientists in such historical fields as archaeology or paleontology use, through a convergence of evidence. Deniers seem to think that if they can just find one tiny crack in the Holocaust structure, the entire edifice will come tumbling down. This is the fundamental flaw in their reasoning. The Holocaust was not a single event. The Holocaust was tens of thousands of events in tens of thousands of places, and is proved by millions of bits of data that converge on one conclusion. Let's examine how the convergence of evidence works to prove the Holocaust, and how deniers select or twist the data to support their claims. We have an account by a survivor who says he heard about the gassings of Jews while he was at Auschwitz. The denier says that survivors exaggerate and that their memories are unsound. An SS guard confesses after the war that he actually saw people being gassed and cremated. The denier claims that these confessions were forced out of the Nazis by the Allies. But now a member of the Sonderkommando, a Jew who helped the Nazis move dead bodies from the gas chambers and into the crematoria, says he not only heard about it and not only saw it happening, he actually participated in the process. The denier explains this away by saying that the Sonderkommando accounts make no sense. Their figures of numbers of bodies are exaggerated, and their dates incorrect. What about the camp commandant, who confessed after the war that he not only heard, saw, and participated in the process, but orchestrated it? He was tortured, says the denier. But what about his autobiography, written after his trial, conviction, and sentencing to death, when he had nothing to gain by lying? No one knows why people confess to ridiculous crimes, explains the denier, but they do. No single testimony says Holocaust on it. But woven together, pieces of evidence make a pattern, a story that holds together, while the denier's story unravels. Instead of the historian having to present just one proof, the denier must now disprove six pieces of historical data, with six different methods of disproof. But there is more. We have blueprints of gas chambers and crematoria. Those were used strictly for delousing and body disposal, claims the denier. Thanks to the Allied war against Germany, the Germans were never given the opportunity to deport the Jews to their own homeland, and instead had to put them into overcrowded camps where disease and lice were rampant. What about the huge orders for Zyklon B gas? It was used strictly for delousing all those diseased inmates. What about those speeches by Adolf Hitler, Heinrich Himmler, Hans Frank, and Joseph Goebbels talking about the extermination of the Jews? Oh, they really meant rooting out, as in deporting them out of the Reich. What about Adolf Eichmann's confession at his trial? He was coerced. Hasn't the German government confessed that the Nazis attempted to exterminate European Jewry? Yes, but they lied, so they could rejoin the family of nations. Now the denier must rationalize no less than 14 different bits of evidence that converge to a specific conclusion. But the convergence continues. If 6 million Jews did not die, where did they go? They are in Siberia and Peoria, Israel and Los Angeles, says the denier. But why can't they find each other? They do. Haven't you heard the stories of long-separated siblings making contact with one another after many decades? What about the photos and newsreels of the liberation of the camps, with all those dead bodies and starving inmates? Well, those people were well taken care of until the end of the war, when the Allies were bombing German cities, factories, and supply lines, thus preventing food from reaching the camps. The Nazis tried to save their prisoners, but the combined strength of the Allies was too much. But what about all the accounts by prisoners of the brutality of the Nazis, the random shootings and beatings, the deplorable conditions, the freezing temperatures, the death marches, and so on? That is the nature of war, replies the denier. The Americans interned Japanese Americans and Japanese nationals in camps. The Japanese imprisoned Chinese. The Russians tortured Poles and Germans. War is hell. The Nazis were no different from anyone else. We are now up to 18 sets of evidence, all converging toward one conclusion. The denier chips away at them all, determined not to give up his belief system. He is relying on what might be called post hoc rationalization, after the fact reasoning to justify contrary evidence, and then on demanding that the Holocaust historian disprove each of his rationalizations. But the convergence of positive evidence supporting the Holocaust means that the historian has already met the burden of proof, and when the denier demands that each piece of evidence independently prove the Holocaust, he is ignoring the fact that no historian ever claimed that one piece of evidence proves the Holocaust, or anything else. We must examine the evidence as part of a whole, and when we do so, the Holocaust can be regarded as proven. The first major axis of Holocaust denial is that genocide based primarily on race was not intended by Hitler and his followers. Deniers begin at the top, so I will too. In his 1977 Hitler's War, David Irving argued that Hitler did not know about the Holocaust. In a classic example of what I call the snapshot fallacy, taking a single frame out of an historical film, Irving reproduced Himmler's telephone notes of November 30, 1941, when the SS chief telephoned Reinhard Heydrich, deputy chief of the head office for the Reich Security of the SS. Himmler ostensibly called from Hitler's bunker at the Wolf's Lair, ordering that there was to be no liquidation of Jews. From this, Irving concluded that the Führer had ordered that the Jews were not to be liquidated. But we must see the snapshot in the context of the frames around it. In its entirety, the log entry says, "Jewish transport from Berlin, no liquidation." It was in reference to one particular transport, not all Jews. Moreover, for Hitler to veto an order for liquidation implies that liquidation was something that was ongoing. If Jews were not being exterminated, why would Hitler feel the need to halt the extermination of a particular transport? And this entry also proves that it was Hitler, not Himmler or Goebbels, who ordered the Holocaust. As Speer observed regarding Hitler's role, "I don't suppose he had much to do with the technical aspects, but even the decision to proceed from shooting to gas chambers would have been his, for the simple reason, as I know only too well, that no major decisions could be made about anything without his approval." Unquote. Whether or not there was a specific order from Hitler for the extermination of the Jews does not matter then, because it did not need to be spelled out. From his earliest political ramblings to the final Gotterdammerung of the end in his Berlin bunker, Hitler had it in for the Jews. On April 12, 1922, in a speech given in Munich, he told his audience, "The Jew is the ferment of the decomposition of people. This means that it is in the nature of the Jew to destroy, and he must destroy, because he lacks altogether any idea of working for the common good. He possesses certain characteristics given to him by nature, and he never can rid himself of those characteristics. The Jew is harmful to us." Unquote. Years later, with his world collapsing around him, Hitler said, "Against the Jews I fought open-eyed and in view of the whole world. I made it plain that they, this parasitic vermin in Europe, will be finally exterminated." Unquote. In between, Hitler made hundreds of similar statements. How many quotes do we need to prove that Hitler ordered the Holocaust? 100? 1,000? 10,000? David Irving and other deniers make it sound like these speeches do not indicate a smoking gun by playing a clever game of semantics with the word ausrotten, which according to modern dictionaries means to exterminate, extirpate, or destroy. This word can be found in numerous Nazi speeches and documents referring to the Jews. But Irving insists that ausrotten really means stamping or rooting out, arguing that the word ausrotten means one thing now, but it meant something very different in the time Adolf Hitler used it. Unquote. Yet a check of historical dictionaries shows that ausrotten has always meant to exterminate. At a December 1944 conference regarding the Ardennes attack against the Americans, Hitler ordered his generals to ausrotten them division by division. Was Hitler given the order to transport the Americans out of the Ardennes division by division? And what about Rudolf Brandt's use of the word? To SS Gruppenführer Dr. Gravitz of the SS Reichsart in Berlin, SS Sturmbannführer Brandt wrote concerning the Ausrottung of tuberculosis as a disease affecting the nation. A year later, he wrote about the accelerated Ausrottung of the Jews in occupied Europe. The same man is using the same word to discuss the same process for tuberculosis and Jews. What else could Ausrotten have meant in these contexts except extermination? And what about Hans Frank's use of the word? In a speech to a Nazi assembly held on October 7, 1940, Frank summed up his first year of effort as head of the General Government of Occupied Poland, saying, "I could not ausrotten all lice and Jews in only one year, but in the course of time, and if you help me, this end will be attained," unquote. If the final solution meant deportation out of the Reich, as Irving and other deniers claim, does this mean that Frank was planning to send lice out of Poland on trains? Himmler made many equally damning speeches. One of the most notorious is the October 4, 1943 speech to the SS Gruppenführer in Poznan, which was recorded on a red oxide tape. Himmler was lecturing from notes, and early in the talk he stopped the tape recorder to make sure it was working. He then continued, knowing he was being recorded, and spoke for over 3 hours on a range of subjects, including the military and political situation, the Slavic peoples, and racial blends, how the racial superiority of Germans would help them win the war, and the like. 2 hours into the speech, Himmler began to talk about the bloody 1934 purges of traitors in the Nazi Party, and he spoke bluntly about extermination and elimination of the Jewish people. This speech, and a subsequent address to the same audience in January 1944, makes it clear that Himmler meant to kill Jews, not just transport them out of the Reich. Interestingly, David Irving agrees. He said, "Himmler is admitting what I have said happened to the 600,000. But, and this is the important point, nowhere does Himmler say, we're killing millions. Nowhere does he even say we're killing hundreds of thousands." Unquote. Irving once again has fallen into the fallacy of ad hoc rationalization. Since Himmler never exactly said millions, therefore he really meant thousands. But please note, Himmler never said thousands either. Irving is inferring what he wants to infer. The actual numbers come from other sources, which, in conjunction with Himmler's speeches and many other pieces of evidence, converge on the conclusion that he meant millions would be killed. And millions were killed. For decades following the war, historians debated the intentionalism versus the functionalism of the Holocaust. Intentionalists argued that Hitler intended the mass extermination of the Jews from the early 1920s, that Nazi policy in the 1930s was programmed toward this end, and that the invasion of Russia and the quest for Lebensraum were directly planned and linked to the final solution of the Jewish question. Functionalists, by contrast, argued that the original plan for the Jews was expulsion, and that the final solution evolved as a result of the failed war against Russia. Under the weight of historical evidence, intentionalism has not survived the test of time. Events, especially an event as complicated and contingent as the Holocaust, rarely unfold as historical actors plan. Even the famous Wannsee Conference of January 1942, at which the Nazis confirmed the implementation of the final solution, has been shown by Holocaust scholar Yehuda Bauer to be just one more contingent step down the road from original expulsion to final extermination. This is backed up by the existence of a realistic plan to deport the Jews to the island of Madagascar and attempts to trade Jews for cash after the Wannsee Conference. Bauer quotes Himmler's note to himself of December 10, 1942. "I have asked the Führer with regard to letting Jews go in return for ransom. He gave me full powers to approve cases like that if they really bring in foreign currency and appreciable quantities from abroad." Unquote. Does this discount the intentionality of the Nazis to exterminate the Jews? "No," says Bauer, "but it demonstrates the complexity of history and the expediency of the moment." He writes, "In pre-war Germany, emigration suited the circumstances best, and when that was neither speedy enough or complete enough, expulsion, preferably to some primitive place, uninhabited by true Nordic Aryans, the Soviet Union or Madagascar, was the answer. When expulsion did not work either, and the prospect of controlling Europe and, through Europe, the world, arose in late 1940 and early 1941, the murder policy was decided on, quite logically, on the basis of Nazi ideology. All these policies had the same aim, removal." Unquote. They may have begun with resettlement, but they ended up at genocide, because history's final pathways are determined by the functions of any given moment interacting with the intentions that came before. The functional sequence went from eviction of the Jews from German life, to concentration and isolation, to unpaid forced labor, to extermination. The second major axis of Holocaust denial is that gas chambers and crematoria were not used for mass killings. How can anyone deny that the Nazis used gas chambers and crematoria? After all, these facilities still exist in many camps. To debunk the deniers, can't you just go there and see for yourself? Deniers do not deny the use of gas chambers and crematoria, but they claim that gas chambers were used strictly for delousing clothing and blankets, and crematoria were used solely to dispose of bodies of people who died of so-called natural causes in the camps. Before examining in detail the evidence that the Nazis used gas chambers for mass murder, consider the convergence of evidence from various sources. This evidence includes official Nazi documents, including orders for large quantities of Zyklon B, the trade name of hydrocyanic acid gas, blueprints for gas chambers and crematoria, and orders for building materials for gas chambers and crematoria. Eyewitness testimony, including survivor accounts, Jewish Sonderkommando diaries, and confessions of guards and commandants, all tell of gas chambers and crematoria being used for mass murder. Photographs, not only of the camps, but also secret photographs of the burning bodies at Auschwitz, as well as Allied aerial reconnaissance photographs of prisoners being marched to the gas chambers at Auschwitz-Birkenau, and the camps themselves. Buildings and artifacts at the camps, and the results of modern forensic tests that point to the use of both gas chambers and crematoria for killing large numbers of people. No one source by itself proves that gas chambers and crematoria were used for genocide. It is the convergence of these sources that leads inexorably to this conclusion. About the gassings themselves, deniers ask why no extermination victim has given an eyewitness account of an actual gassing. This is like asking why no one from the killing fields of Cambodia or Stalin's purges came back to tell tales on their executioners. What we do have are hundreds of eyewitness accounts, not only from SS men and Nazi doctors, but from Sonderkommandos who dragged the bodies from the gas chambers and into the crematoria. We also have the confessions of guards. SS Unterschaffuhrer Perry Broad was captured on May 6, 1945, by the British in their zone of occupation in Germany. Broad began work at Auschwitz in 1942 and stayed there until the liberation of the camp in January 1945. After his capture, while working as an interpreter for the British, he wrote a memoir that was passed on to the British Intelligence Service in July 1945. In December 1945, he declared under oath that what he wrote was true. On September 29, 1947, the document was used at the Nuremberg trials regarding the gas chambers as mechanisms of mass murder. Later in 1947, he was released. When called to testify at a trial of Auschwitz SS men in April 1959, Broad acknowledged his authorship of the memoir, confirmed its validity, and retracted nothing. I give this context for Broad's memoir because deniers dismiss damning Nazi confessions as either coerced or made up for bizarre psychological reasons, while accepting without hesitation confessions that support deniers' views. Broad was never tortured, and he had little to gain and everything to lose by confessing. When given the opportunity to recant, he did not. Instead, he described in detail the gassing procedure, including the use of Zyklon B, the early gassing experiments in Block 11 of Auschwitz, and the temporary chambers set up in the two abandoned farms at Birkenau. He accurately depicted, by comparison with blueprints, the design of the undressing room, gas chamber, and crematorium. He described the process of gassing in gruesome detail. According to Broad's account, 4 minutes elapsed after Zyklon B pellets were shaken through an aperture in the roof of the gas chamber until the shrieks and moans of the victims ceased. Deniers point out that Broad's total of 4 minutes for the process is at odds with the statements of others, such as Commandant Hirsch, who claimed it was more like 20 minutes. Because of such discrepancies, deniers dismiss the account entirely. A dozen different accounts give a dozen different figures for time of death by gassing, so deniers believe that no one was gassed at all. Does this make sense? Of course not. Obviously, the gassing process would take different amounts of time due to variations in conditions, including the temperature, the number of people in the room, the size of the room, and the amount of Zyklon B poured into the room, not to mention that each observer would perceive time differently. If the time estimates were exactly the same, in fact, we would have to be suspicious that they were all taking their stories from a single account. In this case, discrepancy tends to support the veracity of the evidence. The convergence of Broad's testimony with similar witness accounts, and there are plenty more, provides evidence that the Nazis used gas chambers and crematoria for mass extermination. We have hundreds of accounts of survivors describing the unloading and separation process of Jews at Auschwitz, and we have photographs of the process. We also have eyewitness accounts of the Nazis burning bodies in open pits after gassing, and we have a photograph of such a burning, taken secretly by a Greek Jew named Alex at Auschwitz. For obvious reasons, there are no photographs recording an actual gassing. Deniers claim that aerial reconnaissance photos used in a 1979 CIA report to prove extermination activities were tampered with by the CIA. The difficulty with photographic evidence is that any photograph of activity at a camp cannot by itself prove anything, even if it has not been altered. One photograph shows Nazis burning bodies at Auschwitz. So what, say deniers? Those are bodies of prisoners who died of natural causes, not of prisoners who were gassed. Several aerial photographs show the details of the gas chambers at Birkenau and record prisoners being marched into them. So what, say deniers? The prisoners were going to work to clean up after bodies of people who died of natural causes were burned or they were going for delousing. Again, it is context and convergence with other evidence that makes such photographs telling. Also, the fact that none of the photographs records activities at variance with the accounts of life in the camps supports the Holocaust and the use of gas chambers and crematoria for mass murder. The final major axis of Holocaust denial is the number of Jewish victims. Most Holocaust scholars place the total number of Jewish victims between 5.1 and 6.3 million. While estimates do vary, historians using different methods and different source materials independently arrive at 5 to 6 million Jewish victims of the Holocaust. The fact that the estimates vary actually adds credibility. That is, it would be more likely that the numbers were cooked if the estimates all came out the same. The fact that the estimates do not come out the same, yet are all within a reasonable range of error variance, means somewhere between 5 and 6 million Jews did die in the Holocaust. Scholars derive these figures from population demographics, taking the number of Jews registered living in each village, town, and city in Europe, the number reported transported to camps, the number liberated from camps, the number killed in special actions by the Einsatzgruppen, and the number remaining alive after the war. Finally, one might ask the denier one simple question. If 6 million Jews did not die in the Holocaust, where did they all go? The denier will say they are living in Siberia and Kalamazoo. But for millions of Jews to suddenly appear out of the hinterlands of Russia or America or anywhere else is so unlikely as to be nonsensical. The Holocaust survivor who does turn up is a rare find indeed. There were many millions more killed by the Nazis, including gypsies, homosexuals, mentally and physically handicapped persons, political prisoners, and especially Russians and Poles. But Holocaust deniers do not worry about the numbers of these dead. This fact has something to do with the widespread lack of attention to non-Jewish victims of Holocaust denial. Coupled with the denier's obsession with the Jews is an obsession with conspiracies. On the one hand, they deny that the Nazis had a plan to exterminate the Jews. They reinforce this argument by pointing out how extreme conspiratorial thinking can become. They demand powerful evidence before historians can conclude that Hitler and his followers conspired to exterminate European Jewry. Fine. But they cannot then claim, on the other hand, that the idea of the Holocaust was a Zionist conspiracy to obtain reparations from Germany in order to fund the new state of Israel, not without meeting their own demands for proof. The answer to the denier's contention that there was a conspiracy by Jews to concoct a Holocaust in order to finance the state of Israel is straightforward. The basic facts about the Holocaust were established before there was a state of Israel, and before the United States or any other country gave it 1 cent. Moreover, when reparations were established, the amount Israel received from Germany was not based on numbers killed. It was based on Israel's cost of absorbing and resettling the Jews who fled Germany and German-controlled countries before the war, and the survivors of the Holocaust who came to Israel after the war. Needless to say, if reparations were based on the total number of survivors, then any Zionist conspirators should have exaggerated not the number of Jews killed by the Nazis, but the number of survivors. In fact, given the provisions of the reparations settlement, if the deniers are right and only a few hundred thousand Jews died, then Germany owes Israel far more in reparations. For where else could those 5 to 6 million survivors have gone? In reality, the state of Israel as the recipient of German money is a myth. Most of it went to individual survivors, not to the Israeli government. When all else fails, deniers shift from wrangling about intentionality, gassings and crematoria, and the number of Jews killed, to arguing that the Nazis' treatment of the Jews is really no different from what other nations do to their perceived enemies. Deniers point out, for example, that the U.S. government obliterated with atomic weapons two entire Japanese cities filled with civilians and forced Japanese Americans into camps, which is just what the Germans did to their perceived internal enemy, the Jews. The response to this is twofold. First, just because another country does evil does not make your own evil right. Second, there is a difference between war and the systematic state-organized killing of unarmed people within your own country, not in self-defense, not to gain more territory, raw materials, or wealth, but simply because they are perceived as a type of satanic force and an inferior race. At his trial in Jerusalem, Adolf Eichmann, SS Obersturmbannführer and one of the chief implementers of the Final Solution, tried to make the moral equivalence argument. He never denied the Holocaust. His argument was that these crimes had been legalized by the state, and therefore the people who issued the orders are responsible. This was the classic defense used at the Nuremberg trials by most of the Nazis. Since the higher-ups all committed suicide, Hitler, Himmler, Goebbels, and Goering, they were off the hook, or so they thought. We are not off the hook either. Like evolution denial, Holocaust denial is not simply going to go away, and it is not benign or trivial. It has had, and will have, ugly and dire consequences, not only for Jews, but for all of us, and for future generations. We must provide answers to the claims of Holocaust deniers. We have the evidence, and we must stand up and be heard. On the evening of Thursday, May 16, 1996, I walked across burning coals barefoot for an episode of the PBS show Bill Nye the Science Guy. The producers of this splendid science education series geared toward children wanted to do a segment on pseudoscience and the paranormal, and they thought a scientific explanation for firewalking would make for dramatic television. Since Bill Nye is my daughter's hero, I agreed to host the firewalk. Bernard Likened, a plasma physicist and one of the world's leading experts on firewalking, got the fire going, spread out the coals, and strolled across sans shoes, socks, or blisters. As I made my way to the edge of the coals, Likened reminded me that the temperature in the middle of the raked-out path was about 800 degrees Fahrenheit. I tried to focus on his assurance that this was not a matter of the power of positive thinking, but of physics. Remember the example I offered earlier. When you bake a cake in an oven, the air, the cake, and the metal pan are all at 450 degrees, but only the pan will burn your skin. Hot coals, even at 800 degrees, are like cake. They do not conduct heat very quickly. So as long as I strode across the bed without delay, I should be safe. My naked toes, inches away from the glowing red coals, were skeptical. This was no cakewalk, they told my brain. It wasn't, but 6 feet and 3 seconds later, they were none the worse for wear. My confidence in science was restored, right down to my toes. Firewalking. What a weird thing to do. I have filing cabinets and bookshelves filled with the records of such weird things. But what constitutes a weird thing? I have no formal definition. Weird things are like pornography. They're difficult to define, but obvious when you see them. Each claim, case, or person must be examined individually. One person's weird thing might be another's cherished belief. Who's to say? Well, one criterion, the criterion of choice for me and millions of others, is science. What, we ask, is the scientific evidence for a claim? Infomercial megastar Tony Robbins, the self-help guru who got his start in the early 1980s by holding weekend seminars, climaxing in a firewalk, queries his audience, "What would happen if you were to discover a way to achieve any goal you desire now?" "If you can walk on hot coals," says Robbins, "you can accomplish anything." Can Tony Robbins really walk barefoot over hot coals without burning his feet? Sure he can. So can I. So can you. But you and I can do it without meditating, chanting, or paying hundreds of dollars for a seminar, because firewalking has nothing to do with mental power. Belief that it does is what I would call a weird thing. On this tape, we've met a lot of people who believe a lot of weird things. And I can assure you that after 2 decades of tracking such people and beliefs, that I've only scratched the surface in this audio program. What is going on in our culture and thinking that leads to such beliefs? Theories proffered by skeptics and scientists abound. No education, miseducation, lack of critical thinking, rise of religion, decline of religion, displacement of traditional religion by cults, fear of science, the New Age, the Dark Ages revisited, too much television, not enough reading the wrong books, poor parenting, lousy teachers, and plain old ignorance and stupidity. A correspondent from Ontario, Canada, sent me what he called the vilest embodiment of what you are up against. It was a day-glow orange cardboard sign from his local bookstore on which was scrawled, "New Age section, move to science section." He wrote, "I am truly frightened by the ease with which society is substituting voodoo and superstition for inquiry and critical examination," unquote. As a culture, we seem to have trouble distinguishing science from pseudoscience, history from pseudohistory, and sense from nonsense. But I think the problem lies deeper than this. To get to it, we must dig through the layers of culture and society into the individual human mind and heart. There is not a single answer to the question of why people believe weird things, but we can glean some underlying motivations, all linked to one another, from the diverse examples I have discussed in this program. First, credo consolans. In other words, more than any other reason, the reason people believe weird things is because they want to. It feels good. It is comforting. It is consoling. According to a 1996 Gallup poll, 96% of American adults believe in God, 90% in heaven, 79% in miracles, and 72% in angels. Throughout all of recorded history, everywhere on the globe, such beliefs and similar percentages are common. until a suitable secular substitute surfaces, these figures are unlikely to change significantly. Skeptics and scientists are not immune. To the often asked question, "What is your position on life after death?" my standard response is, "I'm for it, of course." The fact that I am for life after death doesn't mean I'm going to get it. But who wouldn't want it? And that's the point. It is a very human response to believe in things that make us feel better. Second, immediate gratification. Many weird things offer immediate gratification. The 900 number psychic hotlines are a classic example. A magician mentalist friend of mine works one such hotline, so I have been privileged to hear how the system operates from the inside. Most companies charge $3.95 per minute, with the psychic receiving 60 cents per minute. That's $36 an hour for the psychic if the psychic works continuously, and $201 an hour for the company. The goal is to keep callers on the line long enough to turn a good profit, but not so long that they refuse to pay the phone bill. Currently, my friend's record for a single call is 201 minutes for a total of $793.95. People call for one or more of four reasons: love, health, money, and career. Using cold reading techniques, the psychic begins broad and works toward specifics. "I sense there's some tension in your relationship. One of you is more committed than the other." "I'm getting the feeling that financial pressures are causing problems for you." "You have been thinking about changing careers." Such trite statements are true for almost everyone. If your psychic chooses the wrong one, the psychic only has to say, "It will happen in the future." And the psychic only has to be right occasionally. Callers forget the misses and remember the hits. And, most important, they want the psychic to be right. Skeptics don't spend $3.95 a minute on psychic hotlines. Believers do. Calling mostly at night and on weekends, most need someone to talk to. Traditional psychotherapy is formal, expensive, and time-consuming. By contrast, the psychic is only a telephone call away. Many 900-number psychics, including my friend, justify it as poor man's counseling. At $3.95 a minute, almost $240 an hour, I beg to differ. Third, simplicity. Immediate gratification of one's beliefs is made all the easier by simple explanations for an often complex and contingent world. Good and bad things happen to both good and bad people, seemingly at random. Scientific explanations are often complicated and require training and effort to work through. Superstition and belief in fate and the supernatural provide a simpler path through life's complex maze. Consider the following example from Harry Edwards, head of the Australian Skeptic Society. As an experiment, on March 8, 1994, Edwards published a letter in his local newspaper in St. James, New South Wales, about his pet chicken, which perches on his shoulder, occasionally leaving its calling card there. Keeping track of the time and location of the chicken's deposits, and correlating them with subsequent events, Edwards told readers that he was the recipient of good luck. Edwards then explained that he took the chicken's feathers to a palmist and, quote, "checked its horoscope and consulted a past lives reader who confirmed that it was a reincarnated philanthropist and that I should spread the good luck around by selling the product," unquote. He ended his letter by offering to sell his lucky chicken crap and providing an address where readers should send their money. Edwards wrote to me exuberantly, "As a firm believer that one can sell anything as long as it is associated with good luck, believe it or not, I received two orders and $20 for my lucky chicken crap." I believe it. Fourth, morality and meaning. At present, scientific and secular systems of morality and meaning have proved relatively unsatisfying to most people. Without belief in some higher power, people ask, why be moral? What is the basis for ethics? What is the ultimate meaning of life? What's the point of it all? To most people, Science seems to offer only cold and brutal logic in its presentation of an infinite, uncaring, and purposeless universe. Pseudoscience, superstition, myth, magic, and religion offer simple, immediate, and consoling canons of morality and meaning. If there were only one thing skeptics, scientists, philosophers, and humanists could do to address the overall problem of belief in weird things, constructing a meaningful and satisfying system of morality and meaning would be a good place to start. Fifth, and finally, hope springs eternal. Humans are, by nature, a forward-looking species, always seeking greater levels of happiness and satisfaction. Unfortunately, the corollary is that humans are all too often willing to grasp at unrealistic promises of a better life, or to believe that a better life can only be attained by clinging to intolerance and ignorance, by lessening the lives of others. Sometimes, by focusing on a life to come, we miss what we have in this life. Science, humanism, and yes, even skepticism, offer a different source of hope, but it is hope nonetheless. It is hope that human intelligence, combined with compassion, can solve our myriad problems and enhance the quality of each life. It is hope that historical progress continues on its march toward greater freedoms and acceptance for all humans. And it is hope that reason and science, as well as love and empathy, can help us understand our universe, our world, and ourselves.